Maxine and Brian, and Keith will be here later. So this is kind of my plan of attack. It's to just give you a quick rundown of all the BBN physics, and make sure you're aware of where the input, nuclear input and particle input comes from, what their size of the uncertainties are nowadays, and how that affects BBN predictions. And I'll briefly go over the abundance observations and WMAP observations, and just show you, you know, the overall concordance picture. And at the end, I'd like to, well, I came up with some ideas that maybe we could discuss later, and I think it might be helpful for the workshop. And so let's dive right in then. So in cosmology, particularly in what we do, there are a lot of assumptions that are generally glossed over quickly or not even mentioned a lot of times. And so I just wanted to mention the main ones that are important for us briefly. Is we always assume that the standard model of particle physics contains at least the minimal content in the universe that we include. So whatever affects the expansion rate or whatever governs the baryon physics or number of neutrinos or whatever, we assume the standard model is at least in there. We also assume the general relativity is okay and valid not only at all places but at all times. So it's kind of a generalized general relativity principle. In cosmology, we always have the cosmological principle, which says that the universe looks homogeneous and isotropic wherever you look. And now, since COBE, basically, and now WMAP and the supernova experiments, there's evidence for dark matter and dark energy, and in their various forms, as we'll hear about today or during this workshop. And all of this kind of includes some kind of universal expansion in the universe, which kind of goes along with the GR. Okay, so now let's jump to the earliest epochs for Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And so we always start the universe when it's very hot, so temperatures above an MeV or so, where the universe is only is slightly less than a second old. The main constituents of the universe are, of course, photons, neutrinos, electron positrons, which are relativistic at this time, and, of course, baryons, which are in the form of neutrons and protons. And at this time, all reactions, strong, weak, electromagnetic, are very fast compared to the expansion time. And so everything exists in thermal and chemical equilibrium, which is nice, and it makes everything very easy. And we can always write down what the neutron to proton ratio is just as a function of temperature and the mass difference of neutron and proton. As the universe expands, we, of course, cool. And when the temperature drops a little bit below 1 MeV or so, the weak rates become slower than the Hubble expansion rate. So basically, your neutrinos stop talking to the rest of the universe, and can no longer maintain the neutron-proton equilibrium. And so also, a little bit after this time, the electrons and positrons start to become non-relativistic. And so they no longer contribute to the expansion of the universe. And they also eventually annihilate. And so this has the effect of increasing the photon temperature relative to the neutrino temperature by that 4/11 to the 1/3, or the neutrino temperature is 4/11 to the 1/3 of the photon temperature. And since we have nuclei, we'd like to make, or we have neutrons and protons, we'd like to make heavier nuclei. Deuterium is the first step, but of course, since we have so many photons around compared to the number of baryons, we just can't do it at these high temperatures. And so we have to wait for the universe to cool so there isn't such a large photon bath that can dissociate deuterium. So this is known as the deuterium bottleneck. And so we just sit around waiting for the photon abundance to get low enough so we can proceed. And while we're waiting for that to end, the free neutrons decay. And so whatever value that this freezes out at, will change by just an extra decay factor. And so now we get to the actual epoch of primordial nucleosynthesis. Once the universe cools to about 70 keV or so, the number of photons capable of dissociating deuterium is about the same as the number of baryons. And so you no longer effectively destroy deuterium. And once deuterium sticks around enough, you go ahead and create rapidly helium-3, helium-4, lithium-7, beryllium-7. But that's short-lived because of the Coulomb barrier and the fact that you've depleted all the neutrons around. And so at about temperatures of about 40 keV, the Coulomb barrier and the depletion of neutron fuel causes nucleosynthesis to halt. And you're left up with a universe that's mainly of protons and helium-4. So all your neutrons get locked up into helium-4. And then you have a few trace elements like deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7. Or at this epoch, it's beryllium-7, which later electron captures once electrons bind to beryllium-7, which is pretty late, actually. It's about 10 to the 5 years, I think. Or 10 to the 5 seconds, excuse me. And the kind of the nice thing is this is all nuclear governed by nuclear physics, going from neutrons and protons through deuterium all the way up through lithium-7. And so the predictions of Big Bang nucleosynthesis are dominated by nuclear uncertainties. And so let me give you a rundown of that list of uncertainties and all of the important reactions. That should be a little n, so for the neutron. The current experiments are at about the 0.1% level for the neutron lifetime. They're kind of a new type of experiment, but they've been around for, I guess, 5 years or so, if I remember correctly. But the intriguing thing is, as of last year, or two, I guess, no, it's 2 or 3 years ago now, there's a new measurement that's 5 sigma discrepant from the previous experiment that has comparable error bars. And so it makes it kind of interesting to see what kind of effect this has on Big Bang nucleosynthesis, because it's this that determines helium-4 and its uncertainty. So this is the thing that dominates that. And so if it's 5 sigma discrepant, we have to be sure of, you know, what neutron lifetime are we adopting, or if we're taking some average of the two, we're going to have to take into account this 5 sigma discrepancy and inflate the error bars to account for that. And then the rest of the rundown is kind of just the standard nuclear reaction network. And you can see that the error bars in all of these range from 1% all the way to 20% or so, with most of the important reactions around 5% uncertainty. And kind of the more meaningful one is in the last couple of years, with the new experimental apparatus, this reaction has been measured a lot better than it has in the past. There's still marginal discrepancy from different data sets, but we can probably push this error bar down to like 7% using modern data.
With the same central points, right? It's not shifting down. If we would shift down by a factor of two.
So this comes, the regime is, are you talking about where it's important for BBN, or are you talking about where it's important for stellar physics? For BBN, it'll change a little bit, just because the old data had quite a large dispersion, but it won't change too much.
It will change the sample value, you say, or will change?
If you're fitting data to a theory, it won't change the central value too much. It actually turns out that the central value is a little higher than the previous cited, but it's maybe 3% higher.
So this is a last year paper, right? 2007.
It's a series of 4 papers, 4 new measurements or so. The Luna collaboration has like 3, maybe 2 actually. There's another experiment done by the guys in Seattle. And then there's a Weissman Institute experiment. I think they might be collaborated with Luna, I don't remember. But the Luna is a low background facility, and so they can actually spend, you know, weeks or months running to get enough data to do it. So they have very low energy measurements.
And the 70% they award like 1 sigma or 2 sigma?
Oh, so yeah, these are all one sigma. And so individual experiments are now measuring things of order 2%, 2 or 3%. And then once you compensate for effect, they slightly disagree that you then the errors will look like to about 7% or so.
Does it seem fair to
inflate the error
by so much? I mean,
yes, it does.
Yeah.
It is because these experiments are dominated by systematic errors. And there's a couple of ways of treating systematic errors, but standard statistical approaches do not work. They always make you estimate an uncertainty that's too small. And so 7% is more realistic. And it gives you about the spread of what the data show you actually too small.
Because the issue, isn't it, that when they measure the cross-section function of energy from point to point, they can do that to a few percent. But the absolute normalization is the hard part, and that's where all the systematics come in. So, you know, internally, the shapes, they can constrain very well. It's the normalization that we care about. That's hard.
Yeah. So those are the two of these. The neutron lifetime and this reaction are kind of the forefront, and a couple other people have measured some of the deuterium-induced reactions. So that gives us the BBN predictions. So this is the standard SRAM plot that everybody sees. And so here we have the mass fraction of helium-4, and the mole fractions or number ratios of deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7 to hydrogen, all plotted against BBN's one free parameter, which is the baryon to photon ratio, eta, or talking in terms of more modern cosmology, omega BH squared. And here, the thickness of the curves is the one sigma error bar. And for some reason, helium-4 looks a little thicker. That must be a plotting issue. But as you can see, the helium-4 abundance is about 0.1%. The deuterium is known to about 5% or so. Helium-3 is known to about 7%. And then lithium-7, because of that helium-3 alpha gamma reaction. Here it's 20%, but if we include the modern data for helium-3 alpha gamma, it'll come down to 10% or so. I want to stress that these nuclear uncertainties, when they come down, they can turn a 2 sigma discrepancy into a 3 or 4 sigma discrepancy. And I think that's something that we should try to push and get observers to go out and figure out more lithium-7 for us. Mm-hmm.
Question about the how to plot the y. So in that case, additionally, did you consider the normalization which was discussed by Cannon at all, the modification of y?
For what? I'm sorry.
Yeah, there is a discussion about 20 years ago or something. Why in Cannon et al. Modification with the normalization of y by hand. So
By ions?
By hand.
The corrections from Coulomb and neutrino heating.
Meaning full effects or something. I forgot. Have you considered it?
Yeah, so these are all those effects are in there, and they're all of this order.
Yes.
But they are included. Yeah.
Is that 0.1% of 24, or is that 0.24? Yeah, okay. It's 0.1% of whatever the number is.
Yes, yeah. Wow. Yeah, so those effects are included.
But it depends on the research or someone.
Some are added by hand, and some are calculated dynamically. But they all yield pretty consistent results. Mm-hmm. And they would all agree in smaller numbers, basically, or slightly smaller.
But given the realistic chances of observing those three elements, this is done, right? There's nothing more to do, right? I mean, there's no need to improve the accuracy here, right? It's only the last one that is still
If we can get a lot more
discussable, right?
If we can get more deuterium to become deuterium, we can try to beat the future CMB experiments.
Right. But what I'm trying to say, it hinges on how you extract it from observations now, right?
Yeah.
Much more than from the program, right? I mean, it's,
yeah. So right now the whole field is limited entirely by observations. That's what we need to understand why people are analyzing helium-4 are getting different numbers, and now people doing deuterium are getting different numbers. And so we'd like to know why. What kind of additional systematics are you leaving out?
Is this the Quano code that you use to generate this?
It's a version of it. It's a Dave Thomas Chicago rewrote block of
that. Okay, because there was a correction for Fermi integrals that changes y by percent or two.
Oh, but we do the Fermi integrals.
Yeah, okay, so the old Quano code had an error. Okay, you fixed that.
Yeah. Okay, so these are the VBN predictions. And so reasonably in the next decade or so, as nuclear experiment comes out with new analyses, these numbers and uncertainties won't change too much. The only thing that will change significantly will be the lithium-7 prediction. You can expect everything to be about 4 or 5% is kind of the reasonable assumption.
What's happening?
Well, like I said, if you use the modern data for this one reaction, you bring this down to 10%. Yes. So and there are a few future experiments in place to measure the same reaction, and others like this, trying to, and it'll be of the same 2 or 3% order. And so if we can find out why the current modern experiments deviate a little bit, then we can kind of renormalize them and really have a true 3% certainty for this reaction.
So people are trying to do this.
Yes. It's a really hard experiment and it takes a long time.
People do this reaction not just because of the VBN lithium, but mostly because of the solar neutrinos.
Yeah, see, the solar neutrinos are this, and this is the dominant nuclear uncertainty in the solar neutrino prediction. Both the beryllium-7 and boron. Okay, so now let me talk about the observations. So helium-4 is measured in extragalactic H2 regions. Basically, the plasma is so hot that you're just getting emission from the helium lines. And as I mentioned before, groups get varying mass fractions for helium-4 ranging from 0.23 to 0.25 or so, all with uncertainties of 0.002. Or smaller, so 1% or smaller. And so the interesting thing is when one group analyzes data, they always seem to have similar numbers to their previous numbers. So it's kind of one group will say they agree with themselves, but not with other people. And so this always kind of screams out their unknown systematics. What are you assuming when you determine these things? So largely, the difference between this is what people assume for the stellar absorption and other ways of calibrating things like electron temperature and such. But in 2001, Keith and Evan looked at the possible systematics, so more than just the stellar absorption, which I mentioned here, and came to the conclusion that the minimum systematic uncertainty that you have in helium-4 is this 0.005 number. It has to be at least that. And if you read section 6 of the Tuan et al. Paper in 2004, they go through all the various systematics. And if you actually calculate a systematic uncertainty based on this, not just a systematic shift, but an actual uncertainty, you get something very similar to this. You get something like 0.004 or so for the systematic uncertainty. And so if anybody's telling you the systematic uncertainty is smaller than 0.004 or 0.005, they're wrong. Well, there is. So if I understand, so 2004, Keith and Evan went back to this, and if I understand the paper correctly, they tried to do the calculation again without making these assumptions about stellar absorption or whatever. They kind of maybe kicked themselves in the foot a little bit by analyzing only helium lines,
And so they didn't have extra information for like determining temperature and what. And so that probably increased the error a little larger than what you would have liked. But they do find that the helium value floats up to about 0.25, and the errors get inflated because now you kind of self-consistently treated all of these effects, or at least allowed for the existence of them. And so the helium 4 observations basically come out to be about 4% or so.
Deuterium. So this is measured in damp Lyman alpha systems via absorption of quasar light. So the quasar is just a light bulb absorbing, and the system containing hydrogen and deuterium are absorbing this light. Most of the systems that have been analyzed, so there's about 7 systems total now that I'm aware of. And I believe 4 or 5 of them only have one deuterium feature that they can resolve. Either the signal noise is too low, or you have so much hydrogen absorption that you can't even see the deuterium features anymore. But a couple systems do have multiple deuterium features. So they'll have Lyman alpha, beta, gamma, delta, whatever, Lyman 13, 15, whatever. And so those systems are very nice. They have good signal to noise. And because you can see multiple deuterium features, you can get an even stronger constraint on the deuterium abundance. So in Kirkman 2003, at that time, there were 2 systems with multiple absorption. So the Omera et al. And Kirkman. Those 2 systems agree very well with each other and give you this deuterium abundance of 2.5 × 10⁻¹⁵. If you include all the other data and calculate the average, you get this number, which is a little bit higher. I should tell you, these numbers have been calculated by the observers, where I trust them to know what their chi-squares look like. A lot of people will try to average these numbers themselves, not knowing the actual underlying distributions. And it turns out that the deuterium abundance is kind of a Gaussian in log space. And so if you're going to do that, you're averaging yourself, you should do it in log space. And then you should be able to get the same numbers as these guys. Because having consistent numbers from group to group is a goal of mine. And more recently, last week, I believe, Patini put on the archive a new paper discussing another analysis of a deuterium system. It also is a multiple absorption system, but the signal to noise is a little ratty. So you can argue that maybe they didn't quite get their errors right. But they find a high value agreeing with the other single absorption line systems, and a little bit discrepant with the Omera and Kirkman at all. And so this probably hints that there are more uncertainties in deuterium than we are accounting for.
But they look like having very high errors.
Yeah, my
own. At least from the first sight, is that they're extremely optimistic about their.
Yeah, my personal opinion is the Patini result is the signal to noise is pretty bad, and I don't think they've taken into account the normalizing the flux accurately. I don't think they propagated that uncertainty well. So I would guess that once they've gone through the refereeing process, their error bars will go up.
I would like to make a comment. I don't know what I'm asking. Question first.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the realistic uncertainty? If you see the error bars which are claimed on those observations, I get actually often a fairly bad feeling about it. Because when you look at the plot of different deuterium observations, then there's much more scattered.
Yes.
And now, since we have the CMB observations and omega B from there, I think we have omega B from there, of course you're tuning in towards values like what Patini finds now.
Yeah.
If he would have come out with a value of 5 × 10⁻¹, he wouldn't even put the paper on the ASCII page, you know. But if he comes out with the correct value, he does it, you know. Mm-hmm. So my personal feeling is that the uncertainties are actually much larger, and that we should like claim a range somewhere between 2 and 4 comes in minus 5. We should also keep in mind that for a long time, like when we talked about this earlier on, we always said that the highest Hilbert value is actually the one we should be giving the primordial one, because Hilbert is always destroyed. You know?
Right. Yeah, but in these,
so now,
yeah.
Put this argument away and claim it's incredibly small now,
yeah.
which I'm uncomfortable with. So,
yeah, so I think the issue of systematic errors is one to be taken into account. And if this is any indication, the systematic error is like 0.25 of times 10 to the minus 5. That would be, it has to be like something like that. But if you're worried about depletion effects, at these high redshifts of 1 to 2, depletion of deuterium is no more than 1%.
No, what I was worried about mostly is if you look at the plot, there are systems like Dendlam and other systems mm-hmm. which show 1.5 at 2 nodules. I think there's one system which has 4 times the minus 5. And those systems are not mentioned. And you like form a bulk average between the central values, which are far beyond the error of estimate in retrospect.
Yeah.
If you show the plot and ask somebody, what do you think is the deuterium balance, they would give you a much larger range. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about how do you assign uncertainties to something that has large systematic errors. I mean, if you don't cite systematic errors, then you're going to get something too small, or a range that's too small.
Plus, you have a strong bias now to find the correct deuterium.
yes. Yeah, everybody wants to agree. But like I said, we have to get the observers to do it. I mean, it was a mistake for somebody to say that BBN was finished and done with. It's not. There's a lot for observers to do. And they kind of stopped when that was said. But we'll see. So after deuterium comes helium 3. So this is actually observed in galactic H2 regions, just like helium 4. There are a lot fewer systems. We can actually see helium-3, and not over a very large range in metallicity. And so actually extracting out a primordial value is problematic, and it's very model dependent. If you read this helium-3 baryometer paper by Benya et al., you'll see that in the little caption of their figure, it says very model dependent, even though they say helium-3 is back as a baryometer. It's not. But that's what they said. So it's very model dependent, and Brian did some work on this too. So trying to get tripped up in my cords here. But there is something that we can do, particularly in light, that we need as many constraints as we can to place on particle physics as we can. Since helium 3 is itself very slowly varying, we can't determine via the measurements we have whether it's increasing or decreasing with cosmic time. And the fact that we know that deuterium is only decreasing, we can take the ratio of helium-3 to deuterium today and then know that the primordial value has to be less than that, which is basically less than 1. And Carson, you were on this paper, right? Yeah. And so this is a good constraint that we've been using. It actually provides, it looks, it seems to be pretty strong in a lot of cases. So that's kind of useful. And then last but not least is lithium. So this is actually observed in halo stars of our galaxy that are very metal poor. And it turns out that these analyses are very, very sensitive to the atomic data. So what kind of opacities are your model atmospheres using? When these opacities change and we're updated with new atomic data, the lithium abundance increased from 1.23 to 2.19. And so you have to be careful in what numbers you're using and how modern your opacity tables or your atmospheric models are. And so right away, this kind of effect screams large systematic errors. And you can already see that the statistical error is pretty small compared to these systematic errors.
Find yet another factor of 2 or 3 just out of these atomic capacities.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with difference of density. So I don't know how much they can push factor of two.
I'm going to say a little bit about lithium observations. So you can ask me that question, and I'll give my cynical response then.
So one of the nice things that I think where this understanding lithium 7 can come to play is in stellar evolution models. If we can build three-dimensional stellar models that can basically build a star from scratch and go all the way to the main sequence turnoff where we're observing these stars, we can get a handle on what kind of processing lithium 7 is going under. And if we can get that, then maybe we can try to do that well enough. We can try to model how much lithium 7 is depleted in stars, and so we can extract a better primordial value. And so if it's a factor of two that we're depleting in these stars during the main sequence lifetime, then we can correct it by another factor of two, and then you can say everything else is whatever. But that would be useful for us because then we would have stronger constraints by using lithium because we've already taken into account these astrophysical effects of the stellar environment to bring this up from 2 to 4. And so then particle physics models would be even more constrained by that same factor of 2. And so these are all the abundances I'm going to talk about. You'll hear more about lithium 6 later. And that brings me to WMAP and their latest five-year results. Things haven't changed too much. The first year WMAP had a varying photon ratio, 8 to 10, of 6.14. The error has gone down from 0.25 to 0.16 or something. So this is including all of the CMB experiments and WMAP and some large-scale structure constraints.
I remember that John Dunkley reported that the value is very different, 6.225 or something.
It depends on what kind of priors you're using in the analysis and what kind of cosmological model. Yeah. This is the standard lambda QCD, lambda CDM. So many acronyms.
Yeah, sometimes I'm very confused. So okay. Do you remember the number 6.225 or something? The reason or model?
I don't remember now.
But it's 6.2 roughly, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
but I think it went up from WMAP 3 a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. It was 6.14 from WMAP fall was 6.1.
And then it went down and went up.
But I mean,
we think but it's not very narrow strict.
It's pretty narrow. But the one thing that is the assumptions in your cosmological model then cause these minor shifts in the variant density. We haven't incorporated them in BBN analysis, but it might be worthwhile to consider those kind of deviations. So whether, because a lot of things like running of a scalar index or assumed helium-4 mass fraction during the CMB or neutrino mass will be degenerate with these small changes in variant density. And so taking those facts into account might be something worthwhile. So it'll obviously inflate the error bars in the variant density a little bit, but we still have pretty good statistics, I think. Okay, so that's my rundown of all the observations. So how does everything fit together? Yeah, all my lines look a little thick to me. We'll see. So this is again the Schrant plot with the helium 4, the changing helium 3, and lithium 7. And you can just see that so the observations will cut out a horizontal band here, and wherever they overlap, the BBN predictions will swipe out a band in the variant density. So a loud variant density. And you can see the box for helium 4 here, those two boxes for deuterium, and these two boxes for lithium 7.
So this yellow one is like 2 sigma?
Well, like I said, my bands look a little thick to me. Yeah. I think it's just this the machine. it looks very wide.
It should be right much more.
Yeah, it is a lot. But you can see, as we kind of expected, helium 4 and deuterium observations agree very well with the BBN predictions with WMAP. Helium-3 is always lower than deuterium, so that's always less than 1. So that's the helium-3 constraint holds very well. But again, lithium-7 is still the problem. It's still deviating by that factor of 2 from the BBM predictions of WM or the deuterium observations. And so this gives us our window of, do we explain it with particle physics, or do we explain it with stellar physics, or more systematic errors? And so that's kind of where I leave off, and I set you guys up pretty well, I think. I'm going to talk about some efforts that my students are on. So at GINA, where I work, as the Joint Institute for Nuclear Astrophysics, we have several programs to try and promote communication and information flow between theorists, experimentalists, and observers. And so one of these is this database of thermonuclear reaction rates that we have, or that I manage. And so these are all normal nuclear nuclide reaction rates. But if you're actually interested in looking at experimental data itself rather than the actual thermally averaged cross-section, you can go to the NMDC and dig up that data. And so if you're going to be calculating these rates for these exotic bound states, it's always good to have not only bound state information, but scattering data. And you can get that at the NMDC. And also Oak Ridge has a bunch of online tools that you can use. They're trying to build a repository as well. Michael Smith is managing that. But they have some nice astrophysical tools and even some stellar codes that you can run on their machines. So it doesn't cost you anything. So that's kind of nice.
What about this DUNL or reviews of this?
Oh, Tunnel? So Tunnel is not being updated anymore. And so that kind of ran out of funding a while ago, actually. Tunnel is basically nuclear structure data on A equals 3 to 20. But also, if you go to the NMDC, you can get that same information, but on the whole nuclide chart. The presentation is not as pretty, but you can get the information.
And all of these are maintained. So
all these are maintained. Yes, and so GINA has a joint collaboration with CARINA, which is the European counterpart, trying to promote these kind of activities. And so this is kind of the stuff that I'm involved with. And that kind of leads me to kind of workshop goals that would be nice. Is it might be useful for us to create some kind of forum where we can discuss these kind of observational constraints and come up with a universal set of observational constraints to be used for particle astrophysics. That way, we at least have a discussion going, and then we can go to the observers with some intelligence and ask them, can you measure this better, or can you do this? And so there's a lot of things we can apply there. But also, once we've done our calculations, we can provide our own data tables for comparison studies later on by future work. And I think that would be very useful to have in a nice localized place. So that way, it's really easy for people to compare, and the data is disseminated very easily. And then there's options of just creating an explicit forum, not just like a repository, where we can discuss whatever new papers or whatever that may be more public than most people would like, but it's also useful, I think. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Richard is so good with the stick because today Detroit is playing the game number 4 of the series against Pittsburgh. He's gearing up for that.
I have a question. You showed just the Allen-Skillman limits on why, but is the Dwan numbers, are they still lower than?
Yeah, they're still lower. I think their recent stuff is 242.
So really, one should include both of those. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, as long as you assume reasonable systematic error,
did Dwan and Skillman really get the big errors, like the...
Alvin's going to do the,
he always quoted a much smaller error.
So. Yeah, so his last paper cited a systematic error, but I know how he estimated it. He gets a systematic error the same size as a statistical error, and the way he did it is an estimate of the statistical error, not the systematic error.
Talked to him, he thought, well, the Olive and Skillman errors were way too big, so I just wonder how that's evolved till now. That was like in 04. I don't know how it's.
I just know that his systematic errors are way too small, and Keith and Evans is probably too large, but they only looked at helium lines. If they would have included other lines from oxygen, say, to get a better handle on temperature and such, they might have gotten a stronger.
Why do you say Dwan is too small?
I know his systematic errors are too small. The way he calculated, so the systematic errors are caused by model assumptions. When he calculates his systematic error, he doesn't change his model assumptions. He's just getting another statistical error. And so it's meaningless. And so you should adopt the higher systematic error of his work.
If W map would met all of any of these CMB experiments, then what have happened? Where do you think we would have been now with eta variant from the BDM? That's, you know.
Well, I think
another part of this question is that if you look at the helium abundance as a function of time, the determinations, you can see that it remains lower, then there is a phase shift at around 2001, and that's of course where double map, but the first balloon-based experiments started showing other variant abundance, and then there is a trend that's going up. You know? And I don't know, I don't want to sound too disrespectful or anything, right? But if I go back and I open the papers with Schramm from the early 90s, I can see that they say, sure thing, the Baryon asymmetry is limited to this range.
Yeah.
And this range, guess what? W map value is outside of this range by a fair margin, right? So,
well, I think we would have
sort of a skeptical person should approach that.
I think we would have had a lot more deuterium systems observed if W map didn't come along, or any of the CMB. Because I know that. Petter's student, what's his name? Scott Burrows. He was working on an automated routine to do this so that rather than taking a year to analyze the data by doing things by hand, he could automate searches in the Sloan data to find these systems first and then automate the fitting program to do this. But he hasn't done anything since on that time, on any of this stuff, really. So there is no automated search for deuterium systems.
It wouldn't have gone as far, like, you know, because,
look.
Well, if we had more systems, we'd be able to answer a little bit more.
Because it is astrophysics, and it's full of systematic errors, you know. Like, there would be a large scatterbrain, and in the end, we'd have to decide on which systems are the cleanest, which systems do you really want to take. And then it gets very, very like shaky to say, well, I let this one out because, you know, what that one to take.
Yeah, but I think if you had a lot more observations of these deuterium systems, you'd be able to start making correlations with heavy elements, like magnesium is seen in these systems, carbon is usually seen, silicon too, I think. So then you can start playing the game of plotting deuterium versus these elements and pulling out correlations and extracting better primordial value, like it's done for helium 4 or lithium 7. So those are kind of things you can do if you have sufficient numbers.
Well, the hydrogen correlation is the column density of some sort.
Yeah, but there's one new measurement by Webb or Murphy that is not on that line. I don't know if it's right, but. Because Scott Burrows and his company reanalyzed that system and it comes back, I think. So it's an interesting regime of stuff.
Well, so let's break for coffee and we can meet in 20 minutes.